Hello, my name is Ben Jenkins. Welcome back to another episode of the ACN podcast, the official podcast of Australian College of Nursing. The three finalists for the 2020 Health Ministers Award for Nursing Trailblazers have been announced, with the winner being crowned via a virtual awards ceremony held on the 23rd of November. For each of the next three episodes, I'm going to be joined by each of the finalists themselves to not only talk about the initiatives that have them recognized for this award as a finalist, but to also talk about their careers as nurses. In today's episode, I'm very fortunate to be joined by Matu Bush. Now, Matu is a nurse practitioner and has started a movement called One Good Street. Its aims to reduce loneliness and social isolation amongst seniors. This initiative has been awarded and recognized both nationally and internationally. And I'm delighted to have Matu talk about One Good Street himself. Now, there are multiple things that come throughout this episode, from talking about One Good Street, to talking about the diversity that a career in nursing can bring, to tips for young nurses coming through, to nurses who might have a great idea who's sitting on it. And Matu provides some absolutely excellent and golden advice. So I hope you enjoy today's episode with Matu Bush. Matu Bush, podcast.
Great to be here. How are you?
Oh, thank you. Thank you for taking the time to be on. I guess I've got to start by saying a big congratulations on being one of three finalists for the 2020 Health Ministers Award for Nursing Trailblazers, particularly for your initiative of One Good Street. That's such an excellent recognition of all of the hard work you do. Now, of course, if I just talk about One Good Street, that's not doing justice of all the other things that you've done throughout your career. And that's something that I definitely want to talk about today. Just for the audience's perspective, I'll start talking about your clinical experience. You've had experience working in emergency, intensive care. You've gone on to become a nurse practitioner within sexual health. You've had managerial positions, been a board member across multiple different organizations. You're deputy editor for the Journal of Health Design. And then more recently, I understand that you are currently working as a general manager for infection prevention for the mandatory quarantine of returned travellers in Victoria as part of the COVID-19 pandemic. You are a very busy man, Matu.
Yeah, sure have. So today I've been to four hotels and walking into those hotels and bumping them into quarantine facilities. And all of my skills throughout my entire career are being used at this fusion point of public health and good service design and experience design, as well as risk management. So one, when I look at my career and think about the clinical aspects, I'm glad that I didn't specialize too early. And I'm glad that I'm a generalist. And when I've just employed a bush nurse, and her ability to land anywhere and know the edges of the risk and know the edges of the problem are really impressive. So I started to specialise in sexual health as a nurse practitioner, but realised that there was so much more that I needed to grow and learn in. So I've kept moving. I've moved through oncology and outpatients, elective surgery, got attracted to how the internal architecture of hospitals work. And then heading out to aged care was fantastic. I loved aged care. And I think everyone needs to do tours of duty in aged care and then link back in, because the broader your breadth of experience in humanity, the better nursing you do, no matter what context.
It's everything links together, doesn't it? You're able to take everything that you've learned and apply it to every new skill. I guess that's what, for me, being only the third year out as being a registered nurse now, that's what I say to graduate nurses coming through and student nurses coming about to enter their graduate program. Is really don't feel discouraged if you don't get the area of what you're after straight away, because every single experience that you have is going to lead on to the very next thing. I think Absolutely. Exactly as you're talking about right now, you're the embodiment exactly of that.
Absolutely. Yeah. It's interesting, the pressure that is on nurses to specialize early, and we talk like that, or what might you specialize in, what might you like, and we don't praise the generalist enough, and we don't have programs to be a generalist across hospitals, across patient flow, across community, and across a whole range of sectors. And then also encourage interest outside. So I've just employed someone who has a marketing degree as well as infection prevention. Now that works well. that's a great combination because it is about communication. And so the more diverse you are in your previous life, please bring your previous life to nursing, especially if you're mature age, because we'll need it. We'll need that. And health problems are wicked problems and require more than just nursing mindsets to solve.
Because Matu, I understand that your background comes from more of a design background. Is that correct?
Correct. I started off in design before I went and worked in international aid. I worked in Calcutta, India, and Tijuana, Mexico. And I worked 4.5 years in international aid in Mexico. And design thinking really does help shape the way I solve problems. So now I'm looking at infection prevention as a design problem. How are we signposting and wayfinding PPE use? How are we looking at the risk of infection as a choreographer would look at it? And how are we dancing with the virus through space and architecture that's not built for quarantine facilities? So I see it as a design problem, and then how to solve for that. How to solve it using design methodology. And a good example is about the gamification of PPE. How to use decks of cards, how to use board games, how to use interactive media that help increase the PPE literacy of people who didn't get out of bed today to learn about infection prevention. Actually, they didn't think they would be doing it in 2020. And one of the privileges I have in working in mandatory quarantine is that I work with pilots who are working in the hotels, with cabin crew from Qantas and Virgin. And we're teaching them a range of things, but they're teaching us about understanding safety and systems. And that's what I truly enjoy about working in the pandemic, is the fusion point of all of these skill sets that's required to solve the problem. And then I bring a design lens and think, how can I solve this as a designer, not necessarily as a nurse?
And so what do you obviously look at your career thus far, and obviously we've touched on the diversity of experiences that you've had. Probably a bit of a broad question to ask, but if I spoke to the Matu who just came out of university, you've got your registration in your hand, did you ever think that you would have led this type of career?
I think I would have known that I would have had an appetite for novelty, which I think is one of the core ingredients of being an innovator, of being a trailblazer, is that you love things that are new and what the promise of something new holds and how it can be used to achieve a range of outcomes. So at that time, I wouldn't be surprised that I'm here, but I would be, I can imagine, probably thinking that I needed to specialise, that I needed to consume a body of knowledge and become safe within that body of knowledge quickly. I think that's the stress for when you first get out on the ward, or you're in ED or elsewhere, or ICU, is consuming as much knowledge as possible so you feel safe in your practice. And I think that would have been my aim. But realizing that knowledge is something you acquire over the long term. So I would have, if I was to write myself a letter, I would just say, lift your horizon line and look at the choices you make for 10 years, 20 years, 30 years. And that makes that consumption of knowledge more manageable and less pressure, because you've got a long career. I think when you first start, you're in a hurry. And so I would have told myself, slow down. You're going to have a long career, but keep that desire for learning something new and your desire for new and novel things, because that leads to innovation.
Matu, taking and following on exactly from that point, now that you've done all of these things, and we'll touch on One Good Street in a second, because again, that's just one of the many things that you do. What are you looking at for 10 years time?
I think it's more around design thinking in healthcare and looking at the wicked problems that are part of our society, the inequity for women, the inequity for people who have disabilities, the inequity for First Nations people. And thinking hard and with them, co-designing new opportunities and new ways for access and equity so that they can flourish, so that we create environments where all humans can flourish, and doing that with a design thinking lens. So the next 10 years is more exploration and I can imagine doing a PhD as part of that to break through with some new knowledge and a deep involvement in technology. There's no advancing in healthcare without fusing technology with ancient wisdom, which our First Nations people teach us, but also fusing it with new schools of thought. So I know a nurse architect. That nurse architect makes the best aged care facilities in Australia. His name's Simon Drysdale. There are others who are fusing their medical or nursing career or health career with things like coding. So they're learning how to code, learning how to create apps. That's where I will continue to provocate in these fusion type individuals who are quite rare, but they are incredibly, incredibly important. Someone who explores the world of, for example, dance is the type of person that I'm interested in walking through a hotel facility to teach me about the choreography of care. That's what I will still be exploring in 10 to 20 years' time.
And Mateo, you're the embodiment of exactly what is possible with a career in nursing as well, because it's really important to keep in mind that you are a registered nurse. You've obviously gone on to become a nurse practitioner. You're highly skilled as a clinician across multiple areas, but you are talking about change at such a large level of coming from a background of nursing as well. So thank you for raising all of that. Now, when it comes to the initiative that's got you recognised, or one of the initiatives, I guess you'd say, that's got you recognised for this Trailblazers Award, for the audience listening today, what is One Good Street?
So One Good Street is an online platform that aims to take the energy within the local neighbourhood and direct it towards people, older people, long-lived adults who suffer from isolation and loneliness. So we're a platform across 5 different states and territories in Australia with over 1,000 members. And we run a range of things like an intergenerational choir. We provide Australia's largest library of aged care things. So that's free aged care equipment. All of the care equipment that you need to look after someone at home, wheelchairs, walkers, recliners, electric scooters, all free of charge. And also things like cycling without age. So we have a rickshaw that we take older people out for bike rides with, as well as really practical help for people who reach our platform and ask for it. So we've got a really strong army of volunteers. And it really also is a political tool where we are activists against ageism. And we see that ageism in our society limits older people from flourishing and also limits the choices that they have. And it first started when on my street, there's a GP and he's 84 and he's retired. And when he would fall out of bed at 3 a.m, his daughter would call me. I'd go and pick him up, put him back into bed. And I realized, there's a whole group of people on our street that keep this individual at home for longer. Now it's cheaper than going into aged care facilities. It's better for us because he's a corporate library of our suburb. Our suburb's less without them. And there'll be times when you know older people live in your street or your suburb, and then suddenly they're no longer there, that they've either died or moved into aged care. And that's a loss because part of One Good Street is understanding the deep value of people who have lived 80, 90, 100 years in our society and what they can offer us. And also that they suffer from loneliness and isolation. So I saw in this GP who lives on our street that there was a group of people that the latent capacity to support him was all there. It was on his doorstep. It just needed to be organised. And I also knew that working with community nurses, that they would go in and do stuff to many older people in our suburbs, but they exit. And it's the neighbours that are there 24 hours. That we in the street can provide much of the solution for the problems of aging. It doesn't necessarily need more government funding, although government funding helps a lot. So I think that's where One Good Street started. The second part was I went to visit a woman once with a community nurse. Her name was Mavis, and she had just turned 101. And she was we were the only people that visited her. And I remember leaving her house, and I looked at my phone, and my social media was a thick market of social activity. Lots of people reaching out, lots of things I could see and get involved in. And I reflected on her thin market of social activity. So I used a market design lens to look at loneliness and realised, wow, this is something we could potentially design ways for connection, given that people really want to help other people. And they do. Australians can do this in a flood, in a bushfire, and in a fun run. Australians know what to do. We come out and we're generous. One Good Street just makes that a little more regular, and it's targeted on those that are most isolated within a community, and usually that's elderly people.
Emma, so even listening to one of your podcasts that you were involved with from the ABC, which I'll link in the episode show notes for the ACN podcast here today, you were, and that was published, what, in January 2019? With that episode, you were mentioning about how you've started the initiative. It's started within sort of sounded like inner city Melbourne. And within a year and a half to pushing on, you've now grown it out to something that is just taken off. You've now got over, what, 1,500 volunteers across five states, territories. It's the embodiment of people coming together and really helping. You've pushed it into a spot now where you're also just going on. You didn't mention before about the giving away all of this equipment, because you've obviously won all these awards and you have taken on and you've built up such revenue in order to help in that way and to give back. Did you think that it was going to take off this quickly? Did you think that people were going to buy into this like this?
I did, because I am constantly in touch with the community in so many ways. I'm a Rotarian as well. So there's always goodwill and people are doing so much stuff. And so I don't buy into the pessimism about a society that's less caring. I think we've understood as an Australian society, as a culture, that there's deep value in social impact, and that social impact can improve your property prices. And to give you an example, there was a suburb near where I live. The auctioneer was auctioning the house, and he said, you want to live in the suburb because of the amount of social capital that's here. And he listed all of the different local initiatives, like the neighbourhood Facebook group, which is so active. About 6,000 people in the suburb are on it, where people give away stuff for free. They help each other out continuously. You've got the garden clubs. You've got all this stuff happening. He's saying this is so valuable, you want to live there. And that's where I got the idea from, of changing the street colour on the website. So if you join One Good Street, you can nominate your street and it changes colour. So on a Google map, you can see the best streets to age in. And then we take that to auctioneers and saying, hey, if you're auctioneering a house, you mention One Good Street, because this has been accredited as being a caring street for older people. So that's all there. And for those of us who have worked in community building for a long time, it's no surprise that these things take off. It is absolutely no surprise that when there is a bushfire, that Australians are incredibly generous. We are amazing at that. It's ways of making it more regular and making that flow, because there's not a fatigue to do it good in the community. And you would know that. And you know that when you see a GoFundMe page for a friend of a friend of a friend who's got cancer, who's like 19, like we respond, because we are ultimately very altruistic as a nation, despite potentially narratives that say we're not. For those of us that work in social care, we know it's there. And so I wasn't surprised that people want to get involved. And also remember, context is very important. We are struggling with our understanding of how we value older people. That's why we have a Royal Commission into aging and aged care, because there's larger societal questions about the value of older people and how much are we willing to scrutinise the systems that surround the care of older people. So I think I've tapped into something that is so topical. And when we have many volunteers in One Good Street, and many of them are trying to redeem the experience of aging that they went through with their parents. They don't want their friends or family or anyone else to go through the difficult palliative care experience at home, for example, or trying to get into aged care, or trying to manage mum and dad as they were getting progressive dementia, but not allowing any care services in. So I hear a lot of those stories. And like, just touching on the library of aged care thing. So I saw, for example, a whole lot of equipment that health services won't touch because they don't, their risk lens, well, I call it a risk cataract. They actually can't see clearly what the possibility is with all of this equipment. They say, it's all got to go in the bin. We're not touching it. We're not liable for it. So that's fine. I'll take it all. I'll get it tagged and tested, and I'll work with Rotary and we'll get it cleaned up. And then we're going to, as part of the circular economy, inject that back in and give it away free of charge. And when adult children who are caring for parents at home come to pick it up, I say, how are you? And invariably they burst into tears because it's adult kids. It's you're in your 30s, 40s, 50s, 60s, working full time, managing your own family, and now you're managing mum and dad. And it's hard work. And it's very gendered work. So many women are bearing the full burden of that sandwich caring. And so they need support. And so the Library of Aged Care things really is for adult children who are caring for older parents to say, hey, it's expensive when mum and dad need the support. And also it's really difficult for them to accept the equipment. So here, why don't you take all this stuff and just trial it and see if it works without wasting any money, and you know, come back, bring it back if it doesn't work, or come and get more. And literally there are times when we've decked out entire houses with equipment. So there was a woman who was palliative. She was 21 years old, palliative, sent home to die with a chronic illness. And on Facebook, someone posted, hey, they can't afford, they're in council housing. They can't afford the electric bed, the pressure mattress, the wheelchair, the commode, the recliner. They can't afford it. And then currently it's $250 a week to rent. It took me less than 6 hours to source all of that equipment and deliver it 24 hours later, so that a 21-year-old who's palliative doesn't have to sleep on the couch. And that's the power of community when it responds. So I'm not surprised that it's happened, because Australians have always been good people.
You've also taken an innovative approach to this as well. You're talking exactly about the library, but then you've also talked about the cat pin. You would explain that, what that one is.
Absolutely. This is really that woman who was 101. It really got me thinking about, we need a surrogate marker for loneliness. And I started to explore what they're doing in other industries. So in the hearing aid world and cochlear implant, they often record the number of words spoken, and they try and increase the word exposure to word count to help the child learn their vocabulary. Also, there was a couple of studies done, and one in particular around postnatal depression, to show that 7 conversations a day is protective from women who are at risk of postnatal depression. It didn't go into the quality of those conversations. It just said 7 conversations a day can make the difference. Then also Microsoft did a whole lot of studies using lanyards that had Bluetooth, that were Bluetooth enabled. And they looked at how long you spoke to people in open plan offices, and also the duration, the word count. So the number of words, the duration you were in front of somebody. And they did that as a study to look at, did open office plans increase productivity? Now, the answer was they didn't. And they increased emails by about 13%. But it showed me the technology was there, but it wasn't applied to older people. And also worked with Bolton Clark, which is an aged care provider. And they would also do a validated assessment tool on loneliness and isolation, but it was a point in time. And I thought, we need a continuous real-time monitor to assess loneliness. So I chose a word counter and developed the concept that if we could have a word counter that counts the number of words people speak, and if it drops below a threshold, so for example, Ben, if you were lonely and I said, right, how many conversations would you like to have a day? And you would say, I'd like to speak maybe 3 or 4 times a day. And then we might set the threshold for 1,000 words. And if you didn't reach the 1,000 words by 3-4 o'clock in the afternoon, it would send an SMS to your friends, family, your neighbours, like all my volunteers from One Good Street, or graft into the support networks that already exist, like the funded volunteer visitor scheme, or the volunteer phone services to lift your word count. And that way, problem solved, you've made some connections that day. And then I worked with jewelry designers because wearables, and there's something that we often talk about in design, is disability beige. Everything that is designed for older people or people with a range of impairments has so little design intent, and it's usually very unattractive. It's not desirable to wear. So we worked with jewelry designers from RMIT University who created this beautiful brooch that is something you desire to wear. It doesn't signal your lack. And the idea is that the technology, you use it for a while and then you no longer need it because you establish the relationships. But we needed a mechanism in real time to assess when somebody is lonely. Now, you and I speak 20,000 words a day. Someone who lives alone may speak none, and we'll be able to publish for the first time in Australia, what is Australia's loneliest day? What is it like to speak only 20 to 30 words per week? Interesting project, we worked with Australia Post on how to use post office people, delivery, mail delivery people, to reduce isolation and loneliness. Because sometimes the people in the service industry are the only people you get to talk to when you're 85 and 95. And I think the epidemic has shown us, or the pandemic has shown us, the importance of service people on maintaining connection with the person that makes your coffee or the person in your shop or the mail person. They give you a sense of connection to a greater ecosystem. And that's what the Cat Pen is all about.
Matthew, for the nurses listening to this now who may have an idea of something that they want to try to implement but don't feel it's exactly their place or don't really feel encouraged to do so, what advice would you provide to them?
Definitely don't stay in your lane. And if someone tells you to stay in your lane, note that that's a person that said that. And then come back to them once you've succeeded, not staying in your lane. So don't stay in your lane and explore other like-minded people. So the startup community is a great place for you to be connected with. So head off, if you've got an idea, let's say you think either it's a piece of technology or just a simple service design or whatever it is. Some of you are yet. Got to meet the right people that can make it happen. Head out to via a range of meetups and other options, head out to the startup community and just immerse yourself in people who spend all the time thinking about something new, new ideas. And that will help you see what's possible. Because in healthcare, because of our risk lens, often we say no to a whole lot of stuff before they give it a try because they don't understand the value of failure. In healthcare, we resist and try and prevent failure because a lot is at stake. But in doing so, we haven't enabled a culture that allows us to fail early and fail often on a range of new initiatives. So if you've got a great idea, find a tribe that will help champion it. And it's not going to be with your nurses. You're going to have to be brave and head out and meet a whole lot of service designers or fashion designers or engineers, or people who aren't involved in your field. Because there are times when healthcare can be incredibly hierarchical and also patriarchal and can crush any kind of new voices and new ideas. So head out and find a different tribe and then you graft it back in. And that's what I've often done in my career, is find a completely different tribe that says we value this and then allow it to develop and then graft it back into healthcare at a later stage. And then they'll be surprised and think it's an amazing idea. Yet you could have come to them in the first place and said, hey, this is amazing. And they would have said no. And that's a common experience for innovators in healthcare.
Matthew Bush, thank you very much for your time to be on the ACM podcast today. And thank you for absolutely everything that you do.
Absolute pleasure. Great chatting with you, Ben.